Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to Tech Makers, the Ubisoft podcast. I am your host, David Usher. I'm the founder of Reimagine AI, the artificial intelligence creative studio. And today on Forging the Future, we're going to talk about action with Josh, Gabrielle, and Julian. Can you guys all introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Josh. I'm really happy to be here and share our thoughts on the topic.
And what do you do at Ubisoft?
I'm an R&D scientist, so in charge of the research and development. And I work on pushing the state of the art in artificial intelligence and trying to find interesting topics and interesting applications inside of Ubisoft and games.
Hello, I'm Gabriel. I'm a R&D developer. I'm working closely with Josh. My focus is more on the technical side, how we push all those innovation into game and how to improve our capacity to iterate.
Hi, I'm Julian. I am a technical architect at Ubisoft Montreal. I've been working on the on previous Far Cry games during the past 10 or 12 years, and right now working on an undisclosed project. And I am working with Gabriel and Josh to integrate the kind of magical technologies that they are brewing at LaForge.
So, okay, let's start with the magical technologies and then move to the secret project. What kind of tech are you guys working on?
Yeah, that's a really good question. What kind of tech are we working on? No, it's, well, really, for us and our team, we're really interested on bots, and that's the main driver for the research. And so the main tool that we've been using is deep learning, and in particular, we've been using reinforcement learning, so deep reinforcement learning, hence the term, and basically training bots like you would train up a dog to do tricks. That's kind of the best way I like to think about it. So you would give it rewards and treats for doing good things. For the bot doing the thing that you want it to do, and potentially penalties and punishments for things that the bot is doing that you don't want it to do. And so that's a high-level idea of what we're doing. And so then what can you train a bot to do, and how can that be useful for building next-generation games? That's what we're after.
Cool. So it's sort of plus one, minus one stuff. Is it mostly for physical? Is it for language? What's the focus?
Yeah. That's a really good question, because, of course, you have bots do a whole bunch of different things. The main angle for us has really been, I mean, there's two different phases to it, but really like a bot kind of working in a physical sense, like a player. So if you picture yourself playing an open world game or something, that those are the kind of bots that we're usually after. It doesn't just have to be exactly like a player. It could be a non-player character. It could be any types of other different things, but usually a physical character.
So can you describe exactly what SmartNav is?
Sure. Yeah, so SmartNav is a really cool technology that we've built that essentially solves the task of being able to navigate from point A to point B on a map. So you have an actual character that's being able to navigate and can use all of the abilities available to a player, jumping twice, so interrupting your first jump with a second jump in the air, all sorts of cool abilities like zip lines, sprints, all sorts of really cool things that potentially classical techniques in the video game industry haven't been able to solve as efficiently. And so with that in place, using deep reinforcement learning as our driver, we're able to learn essentially a mapping from a state of inputs, like where the character is on the map, some visual representation, to actual gamepad actions. And so the character learns how to actually output actions on a gamepad.
And what kind of things are you getting these characters to do?
The first thing that we try to address is how to move in the world. It's really important because it's the first thing that you see from a character. It's how we move in the world. So it was like a starting point and be able to go from point A to point B, but having really this feeling that you are part of the world. So you learn in the world how to move instead of being a puppet or having an algorithm that just say, okay, goes following this straight line. Here, it will more interact with the world. And it's really interesting because also learn to use its own ability, its own speed, according to its own environment, and it gives very organic feelings that it's really interesting.
Are you guys using multiple AI bots in concert together, seeing how they react together, those kind of things?
That's a really good question. So if you're just training an agent to, let's say, navigate from point A to point B, in a sense, you don't need other agents in the scene, right? It could interact. But to actually speed up the training, we want to actually have as many agents as possible in the game. So actually, as a byproduct, sometimes they could potentially collide with one another. And that is something that is interesting to see, that they'll actually learn, oh, if I want to get to my goal position as quickly as possible, I shouldn't be colliding with other characters. So they'll actually kind of learn to do some minor avoidance along the way. So they are interacting to some degree.
Have you guys seen a lot of unintended consequences?
I think there's always, I mean, I think with every deep reinforcement learning training, there's always something that you're surprised by. Either the bot figured out some little nook and cranny that you didn't think even existed, or potentially it's just, why is it, for example, our bots originally tended to just jump a lot. And that was one of the things. They were just, instead of just walking towards their target, like maybe a human maybe would initially, or maybe what a pre-scripted bot would do, actually. You would just script the bot to run in a straight line. But because we gave the agent the ability to jump, because we needed to be able to reach high places, it just repeatedly kept on jumping and jumping and jumping. And we're like, why is it doing that? And as it turns out, because we didn't give it the ability to sprint yet, it was just as fast as walking. So from its perspective,
same thing.
And actually, it could help it get over some obstacles. Right. So it might as well just jump.
Right. That's interesting.
I'm jumping on this. Interestingly, what's amazing with that kind of approach for navigation is that the model uses very high-level concept. As you said, it's about sensing your environment and leveraging your abilities. And obviously, the result depends a lot of your environment and your abilities. And the example Josh was giving was regarding that smart enough technology used in a specific Ubisoft game that was Hyperscape. And when actually we started to adapt and integrate that technology in my project with a different engine, and obviously the agent have different physics and different abilities. And it was interesting because it actually solved straight away that crazy jumping, because in our engine, the character can sprint and run, and naturally he stopped to jump for no reason and actually just leveraged the running, and it created a very natural motion. And he even leveraged other abilities that were at the time in the game available, like wall running and those things, without telling the initial models that those abilities exist. So it's a...
Right. So the environment had more abilities, yeah. So it automatically adapted to and sucked in those abilities into its system.
Another example, like in our setup, we had things like zipline.
Yeah.
And without even explaining the model that kind of contraption exists, he actually learned that it's useful because it's fast to go somewhere with it. And you shouldn't try to press action button to eject. So you learned actually to use it to go to cross the map and use it properly without any extra information. So that was really eye-opening for everybody.
I'm really interested in how it goes from, in the Forge, it goes from essentially research, experimental to prototype. Like, how do you go through the actual process of integrating it into a real game?
Who wants to tackle that one?
Anybody? Yeah, it's a kind of chicken and egg problem, because on the production side, obviously, everybody is always excited by new technology and doing new stuff. But the price is expensive, because by definition, those technology hasn't shipped in a real game yet. So you know that you will have a lot of problem, like, is it efficient enough? What the performance is regarding CPU, memory, it needs to work in the end. How can you fix everything you need to fix when you release the game? So you can't just hide the problem you don't want. You need to fix everything that happens. So there is a huge step between, okay, it's working in R&D prototype and it's promising, and now the technology is mature enough so you can, it can fit with all the production constraints. So that's why I say it's chicken and egg, because everybody wants it, but as long as nobody has actually shipped with it, everybody is a little bit afraid to, do we put money on this and add additional risk?
Right. Of
so
course.
You need to find the right person, the right timing to say, we think that what they are doing at LaForge is mature enough so we can take the risk to try to to use it in the production, but I would say using kind of backdoor to introduce it, because if you say, oh, the whole game will actually break or succeed around this, it's too risky for everybody. So you need to find a way to integrate that technology in a way that it will be used by the game. But if you need to pull the plug or if you need to rescope where it's used, you can still live with it. And that's really the tricky part. And usually that's a tension in game production. There is a huge competition between studio, project, technology, engine. So obviously everybody will always want more. But on the other hand, you have a few years to ship a product, so you can't risk introducing new technology that easily. So usually a lot of production wants to stay with what is proven. So we are really at that point. And on the bet is to make sure that you don't start too early, because it might not be mature enough and it's going to be a fail, and that could delay using it for years. If you are too late, obviously, that means other people will find that kind of solution and you might be lagging from a competition standpoint. So it's really that kind of technological window where are we ready to start and are we ready to take that risk? And we are actually here, so we'll see where it's going.
Are you guys ready to ship now to production? Is it?
I mean, are we this specific technology, SmartNav? What's really impressed me is actually that regardless of what engine, what game we put it in, it works.
Okay.
So that's what's really cool about it. It's kind of blown me away a bit, even. So that's really cool. But I just wanted to add one more thing. It's kind of our job to make the prototypes that we're building, not necessarily inside of the actual game engines, look as good as possible so that it does convince people to actually internally want to use it. That's kind of key. And they don't see it as this huge risk. There's always going to be that risk because our internal prototypes that we're building, our little toy environments to test the ideas, aren't real games. And so they don't look necessarily like a real game. They don't act exactly like a real game. But that's kind of part of the research side of the equation, to make the research look as cool as possible in a way so that people in productions are excited.
So you have to really entice the people in production to want to use it and to say, I really need this in the yeah. game itself.
But it's right. So we want to be sure at the first step, even when we do just a research prototype in a very simple environment, game environment, to have people from production as stakeholders to follow what we do, to show them the possibility, but also to have feedback to be sure that we go in the right direction, that will help a first implementation in the game to show that, yeah, it's possible also in a true game or in a true game engine, and advance step by step, cautiously. It's really, really impressive to see that now it works in different game engine, different environment. It's really cool.
How does failure work within LaForge? Like, because I mean, a lot of research ideas, you know, you, especially if you're trying to integrate them with something that's production, might not do what it's supposed to do in the end.
So Lucat is a great example.
Yeah, I think it's actually a really good example. So we have a bot that can navigate really well, and this is, like I said, consistent across any engine we throw it in, but then we want to add potentially an additional constraint to the problem. So now we potentially want it to also be able to aim as it's navigating. And that could have a bunch of different interesting plays on the navigation, because maybe now it can't sprint at the same time as it's, if it has to aim to the left, and now it wants to sprint towards the goal that's in front of it, it actually has to balance that constraint. It can't do both at the same time. So it actually is a very difficult problem. And so essentially, things weren't really working as we expected. So adding that additional constraint kind of broke what we were doing. And we went back to the drawing board, came up with a whole new research idea to kind of integrate that into SmartNav. And then, you know, 6 months later or whatever, however how much time I've kind of lost a bit of track.
60 months later.
So now it's 6 months about, you know, we have some really cool prototypes using that.
Okay.
And I think it also shows us, I think, the kind of future circle we are trying to create. It's because that look at constraint came actually from the integration we did in the project, where we want both to look at and shoot at things. And obviously for LaForge, it was kind of, it's potentially a custom style, but maybe it's something that is more or less relevant. But for a game centered around shooting, it's absolutely critical that it's not just about moving around, but being able to look at things. And obviously, so I pushed to say, okay, no, this is not just a customization. This is the customization. And so that puts the emphasis on where do we where should we go regarding R&D? It's the R&D is coming with the solution. We use it and we see real problem for real game. And that give hints to the R&D to say, if you invest more time, that should probably be in that direction because that's where we want to go. And that's the kind of exchange that is very exciting between production engineering and I would say more research and development.
What is really interesting is what gets out of it. It's not just a move on AIM. It's a new way to work on the reward because it's always difficult to tell, okay, to fine-tune what is the good and the bad behavior. And thanks to this, we're able to give constraints, say, okay, I want your main task is to move to this direction, but now I will give you a couple of constraints. And it's easier to define those constraints. So it's a new tool also for the designer to be able to work with this new technology.
So the designer can add constraints as well? Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it really is a cool project because it kind of goes full circle. There's this need in the production that we couldn't meet. We tried with our basic approaches. It wasn't working. And then we really needed to invest some research time. So we actually had a student come in. He was doing his PhD, came up with this really cool algorithm, you know. And so it really is this full cycle thing. And then we're back and it actually works really nicely. And we have some even more than just solving the original problem with the look at, we can now deal with a whole bunch of other problems. Like, for example, before with the jumping, if we didn't want our agent to jump that much and we didn't want to change the game to add a sprint, we can now add an extra constraint. Don't jump too much, basically.
Like, right.
So like, we have all these extra little knobs that we can play with.
So
the design part is interesting because that's the thing that moving into production bring, and we are not at that stage yet because even if it's working in the game as a real feature, obviously it's not really in full production yet. But that's also what you need to learn as well going into production. It's obviously to solve a lot of technical issue, but also when we say that the tech needs to be integrated in production, that means that people will have to use it, and in particular designers, they will have at one point to understand some of it, maybe not all, obviously, all the machine learning behind it. So, but they can understand how to play with it and how they can tweak it. Because obviously, in the end, if that kind of technology is successful in the coming years, that means that it's going to be a feature that will have to be tweaked by non-programmer, by designer, and it will have to solve practical problem for a game. And that's also the goal into going into production is to explore all the dependency between machine learning and technology and design needs and production constraint. So it's a long road ahead.
So you were talking about an unnamed project.
Yeah.
So are you allowed to talk about anything about this unnamed project?
Not really.
Some secrets you can give out just to me?
Yeah, not really, but you know a little bit. Obviously, there are some agents and boats and they are moving around and potentially they want to look at things and shoot at stuff. So,
You've given it all away.
And there is a zipline.
Sorry?
There's a zipline, exactly.
There is some zipline.
Yeah.
The zipline game, well, exactly.
This could change because...
So you were talking about bringing in PhDs, I think, or undergrads, students. How does that onboarding process actually work at LaForge?
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. So, I mean, we're constantly trying to have like an influx, like an inflow of students, because obviously it's going to be fairly short term. We usually aim for at least a 6-month project, but it could be longer. We could actually have PhD students stay on for their whole PhD, which could be several years. And so there is really a big range of the types of projects that we're trying to tackle. The hardest ones are actually the short-term internships because by the time, like you said, onboarding people and then having them potentially do something productive, you know, these interns aren't just getting coffee. They're actually working on the research, the core research problems. So, and then having them, you know, write up a little report at the end, if you try and do that in 4 months, it almost never works. So it actually is a bit of a game because you have this time limit component to it.
How are they brought in? Are they brought in as staff, or are they brought in as interns, or how is it?
We actually have different mechanisms.
I'm just curious.
We actually have different mechanisms. We can bring them on as regular interns, and then we could bring them on as more long term. I think the more long term students have potentially different titles, and there's different grants and whatnot that we can work with the universities. So it is a bit intricate to play with universities. Obviously, if you're taking someone's student from them for a year or two, there has to be a collaboration with the professor. So it is a bit of an intricate business there.
Okay, interesting. And how do you find them?
Good question. Fortunately, we're currently in one of
podcasts like this.
Yeah, podcasts like this. We're currently in one of the AI hubs of the world, like this city, beautiful city of Montreal. So plenty of universities working on AI, plenty of students. So a lot of them come from Montreal, but not solely from Montreal. So that's definitely part of it. We meet them at conferences that we publish in. We meet them at all different events. We do some events where we just talk about our research at different universities, at different venues. So it really is, there's a bunch of different ways.
Interesting. So can you guys talk a little bit about your experience at LaForge? Like it's been around for 5 years, I guess, around 5 years. And how has it changed for you guys? How has it grown? And what are your feelings about it that way?
So I don't know who, maybe you should go first, Gabriel. I think you have.
So the listeners can know, he's rubbing his face around his forehead, which is never a good sign.
No, I saw LaForge happen on the growth, and it was really interesting because at the beginning, it was very not a lot of people trying to look for what is a good topic, how we can convince people, how to gather people from production to follow what they're doing. So me, at this time, I was on production. I was working on Assassin's Creed, and they were doing some very interesting work on a battle on fight boats. So I was curious about it. They were also doing work about how to drive a car autonomously in a game. But the first year were kind of difficult because we had good prototypes, but it was hard to have them in the game, to reach the game. And I think it's also where they really grow over time, is to have more connection with production, more visibility on more solid topics.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, yes, it's a... I don't know, I guess 5 years ago, how complex people thought it would be, but it's... Even within the same company, it's very hard to move technology, even super exciting one. I saw prototype 4 or 5 years ago, and it was already cool. But as you can see, it takes years to create, even internally, those links, that trust to be able to go in production. And after this, you still need to wait for a few years to luckily see the result of all of this in a game that will be publicly available. So hopefully in the next couple of years, 2 or 3 years, there will be a few Ubisoft games that will be released, and actually some of those technology will be in it, but as you can see, it's between 5 or 10 years from the drawing board and creating the structure for R&D at Ubisoft and having practical result, and I don't think it's that easy to make it faster.
Yeah. And I'd like, just adding in terms of like working at LaForge, so I've been working there for almost 2 years now, straight out of my PhD. So I finished my PhD, I joined. I really love the work culture that we have. It kind of has this small like startup vibe, which is kind of what's going on, although we are expanding to different offices around the world. So now it's kind of, it's growing, but I think we're not losing that close-knit culture. And I think it's really important to have that kind of culture when you're trying some crazy ideas on the research side, and having that that freedom to kind of try things that might not necessarily work but are kind of out there.
Also, I think for all those people working in machine learning, obviously it's in demand in every industry now. But I think Ubisoft and the video game industry as a whole is maybe a specific age, because it's like every technology, if you apply it to a topic like video games, it's obviously for a lot of people, I think it has a specific interest and specific vibe. And also you are able to work with, in our case, the Ubisoft studio. And that means that you have access to amazing artists, amazing data. So that means that your model, and SmartNav is a good example, all the technology was working with a cube jumping around. And obviously it proves that everything is working and the complexity is actually here. But when you start to transfer this and you start to see it moving with a AAA character who is world-class animation and models and environment, the exact same technology actually take your life on its own. And I can imagine that for researchers that probably most of them don't have access to that kind of quality assets, it's probably an exciting incentive to actually see your technology applied to that kind of context.
Yeah, 100%.
For me, one of the key factor of success of LaForge is really to make this bridge between academic and production, to be sure that we don't just do research for the sake of doing research, and to be sure to be grounded always in production. And also to have the production that accept to take some time to do research, don't expect everything to work instantaneously, but okay, it will take 6 months, it will take years, possibly. And it's for me, it's really the source of success because I've often seen initiatives where we try to do research and it just spin like because it's not related to production and it's not grounded in real needs and it finished to stop. So I really like this formula and I'm really happy to show that 5 years later, it proves the success.
That's very cool. I mean, it's very interesting that even within the balance between LaForge and production, there's the actual creating of the prototype, but then there's the actual, you need to package it in a way that can spark the imagination of production to want to play with it and want to adopt it. It's very interesting. So if you can give me the future of SmartNav, what is it going to become? What's the grand plan?
In our case, one of our goals is to try to create a new breed of NPC, non-player characters, based on machine learning. But what we try to do right now, again, to make sure that we find the right scope, SmartNav is interesting because it's here to solve only one problem. It's a big one. It's navigation. It's the foundational feature for an NPC. Whatever you do as a creature, if you can't move from A to B, you can't do much else. So SmartNav is here to solve that kind of thing. When I say this, in our specific case, we are not trying to use machine learning to create a bot that do everything. And that's the kind of research that exists, and it's super exciting. So they basically, for example, just look at the screen and they learn to behave in the world just by looking. So it's super promising, but it's super expensive. And if you want this to work in a real game, probably that kind of model is, as of today, way too expensive for your console, your PS5, or your server. So interestingly, with SmartNav, it's still a complex model that is expensive. But it's more manageable from a performance standpoint. So that means that we can build an NPC and technically replace the classical technology we use for navigation, and we try to cram that technology inside. And right now, it's working pretty well. We still have a lot of things to solve, but technically, it's working. So it's a way to grow that machine learning approach, but without putting all our eggs in the same basket. So, because the goal is hopefully in 2 or 3 years to be able to ship something that is functional and that is that can work for the project. So it's a very good trade-off by actually trying to solve something specific, and after we can grow it, we can maybe have machine learning that solve much more behavioral problems. But it's a very good way to tackle a specific problem.
Yeah, and I think we actually spoke about one of the examples of, you know, the future of SmartNav with being able to handle, like, you know, looking at a target, for instance, and doing the aiming, because now the model could navigate and it could also aim. And so now you could really think about building an NPC with this at its core. There's so many other interesting research problems, like, can a model train on a few maps and then be able to generalize to new maps it's never seen before just because it's able to navigate? Can we do long-term planning? And what I mean by that is not just be able to navigate locally, which is kind of what our agent does, although it does actually work pretty well on decent-sized maps for like a few hundred meters squared. But, you know, extending that beyond that boundary and solving open-world maps, right, which is what we're kind of known for here. So it's like, so, you know, there's a lot of interesting research problems that are still unanswered with SmartNav, although we have some solutions to handle everything. There's still a lot to do there.
We have a lot of online games, multiplayer, where we don't have bots because players have abilities, navigation abilities, where we don't really have currently AI solution for those abilities. So thanks to SmartNav, we'll be able to use all those different abilities by learning how to use them. And what is interesting, it solves two problems with OneStone. Not only we can now use those ability, but the result is really more player-like. The behavior is really more player-like. So it's a side effect, but it's a really good side effect for us.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, guys. I totally appreciate the time. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
So thanks for listening to Tech Makers, the Ubisoft podcast. I'm your host, David Usher. And next time, forging the future, responsible tech. See you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.